Well, thanks, Jerry. I need to lead off by expressing my humble gratitude to be invited back. I'm a person that's taken the road less traveled for most of my life, and for you to invite me back is an extreme honor, especially with if you look at the powerhouse speakers and scientists that were just here. It's fun to be here. It's fun to be back in South Dakota. Moving to Texas in January, I call myself Barry in Wonderland. I jump down the rabbit hole, and there's all kinds of new plants, and there's all kinds of new animals, like javelinas and armadillos, and there's all kinds of new people, and it's really exciting, but it's been a little bit of a shock, too. So it's really great to be back. We're going to talk a lot about, or this conference is talking about technology and what great speakers we had last night and really, really cutting edge. But if you know me very well, you know that I always wear the hat of the rancher that I was and maybe always will be. And so I'm going to look at the price tag and profitability of technology from that rancher, from that cowboy's perspective. And I'm going to maybe drag us back a little bit. I'm going to use some examples that I know are simplistic, and if you'll just go with me, I'm not going to challenge the future technologies that we've heard about in the discussions very much that I'm going to do today. But I hope you do. I hope you'll take kind of the historic examples of the price tags of profit and of technology and the profitability of technology and take that leap for me, because it's one we really need to take. For a long time, I think technology has been defined in this industry, and we've heard it throughout the talk yesterday and today, that it is a specific product, vaccination, medicine, it's implant, And I think that we've been trapped in that paradigm of technology. But the speakers last night talked about really being able to move things when they apply multiple technologies together. And as this industry moves towards this aligned production systems, however you want to define alliances and all the things that go with it, aligned production systems, I think technology, we're going to see technology kind of redefined as a set of protocols or procedures to get an animal through a system, and it might include implants or exclude implants. It might include this product and not that product, but it will be well-defined. So I'm going to expand the definition of technology today to include protocols and procedures that animals are going to pass through, because I think they're going to be very well-defined in the future. Now, the adoption rates in technology vary a great deal, and as you know, in the beef cattle industry, they are relatively low. The new NOMS work should be coming out soon. I must admit, I've lost track of a few things as I made that 1,400-mile trek south, and I don't think the new NOMS report's out, but the 98 NOMS report certainly did indicate that only about 20% of the available technology in the beef cattle industry was being applied. That's industry-wide, including the feedlot sector. So, and it really lags in the cow-calf sector, and there's lots of reasons why, and I'm not here to discuss that with you, except for one slide. But that's just a fact. The rates of adoption of technology vary between this very segmented industry that we have, and it varies greatly within segments. Not so much in the feedlot and the packing industries today. They've probably gotten this thing narrowed down pretty to a large degree. But in cow-calf, especially in stocker yearlings, this rate of adoption is very, very wide. The other thing that's happening that I think is almost a shock to our system is the incredible speed at which the market is signaling change for our industry. December 23rd, sent a shockwave through this industry. To our credit, the industry responded extremely well. But that's just one coming, isn't it? And we know that there'll be more, and we know that those issues will be coming at a faster rate. And the repercussions, although the industry rebounded so well, we still have trade issues, don't we? And so what are we doing with lots of parts of the animals that we used to be shipping overseas that we can't ship right now? It's a huge challenge to our industry. The other thing that, and I've when I took an extension position in South Dakota State, I knew that I needed to learn, how people adopted technology. So I dug into the work of Everett Rogers, of the great Iowa State researcher, who I think is still alive and must be 80-something, just did tremendous work on this. And Everett Rogers used the hybrid seed corn model to describe adoption rates. And Dr. Tallman last night mentioned that the early adopters made a lot of money on technology, and he's exactly right. But and Dr. Rogers' work supports that. Now, there's one group ahead of that adopt technology ahead of the early adopters, and they're called innovators. Now, the innovators are a relatively small part of any population, and they adopt technology at extremely rapid rates, and we probably, if you think about it, you'll know them. They'll adopt any technology that comes through a magazine. And as I went south last January, I took a picture of an operation, kind of like the sign, the Bar X Cattle Company. Now this fellow, as I came back last weekend, I went by the same sign. And this man, I knew that I needed to show you this, because this fella is an innovator. He's already got his premise number on his ranch sign. So we go from bar X to TX0012567, whatever that's going to be. I say that in jest, because I really do think we better be careful about what we lose and what we gain in some of the adoptions of technology. I just started a little laundry list of the things that are available for ranchers and farmers and feedlot operators and people to use. And we've heard about the latest technologies and certainly AI and ester synchronization and on down the line. And then the animal ID deal is really a burgeoning technology, and for my family, the L7 brand was, and I still have the L7 brand. In fact, I got the L7 brand in Texas, and I was pretty pleased to do that. And I didn't have to, just paid $10. But the brand has certainly been a great premise identification for this industry west of some areas for a long, long time. It served the industry very, very well. But as society became more complicated, that I think this cartoon shows it very well. And I'm not sure everyone can see it, so I'll read it for you, especially when it's backwards on a branding iron. The branding iron says, "This cow belongs to Daryl Jones, so hands off." And the problem with that type of brand is this, and that huge fire wrecks the leather for the King Ranch pickups, which I really think we should increase the sale of, since the endowment of my program is directly related to the success of those programs. So we change, and there's a new way to identify animals, and I've been pushing this one, and if I could just get the adhesive down, I think I'd have a great product, and if somebody wants to join in a venture capital deal with me, I'm ready to go. I tried a Walmart scanner, you know, the garden guy, the people out in the garden department of Walmart have those portable bar scanners, and it really works well, other than it keeps telling me that this cow is a Budgonia for $9.99. So, another huge problem in this industry is that the the obvious correlation between the adoption of technology and profitability is really mixed up and hard to see. And I have been on ranches that would be described like this one, where there, and I've been on several since I moved to Texas, where there's no animal ID. They round up cattle once a year with helicopters, and I think there's some folks from Australia, and I think they do that there too. They brand and sell the cattle that are of market age. They sell the dry cows and don't dehorn, and because the horns are a positive thing, because there's mountain lions in South Texas, and so off they go, out the cows go, and they go round up another, zillion acre pasture, and they do that thing year round, and they just sell those cattle. Now, the kicker is that those ranches can be very, very profitable. So forget about the oil deal. That, as I've learned, the oil's been zapped off by other mineral rights are gone for a lot of those ranchers. But they can make a lot of money in very expensive systems that apply none of the technologies that we are here to discuss in the Beef Industry Federation, because youth has been integral in getting into our industry. Because you can go into Walmart and buy a very tender steak for $8 a pound, because it's been injected with some salt that makes it very tender. And so a tenderness gene to a ranch like that is probably irrelevant. And they can still make a lot of money. And they can manage natural resources and have sustainable operations. Now the other operation, another one, and I'll call it the intensive operation, I've been on them. There's many of you in this room would be in this group that where animals are all identified, probably with the barcode now or some ear piece or implant or something. There's a full array of vaccinations. There are very tight breeding systems, ester synchronization, AI, DNA testing, you name it, it's being done, and they are very, very profitable and sustainable. And I've been on these ranches in South Dakota. I was on one in Texas. I've been on one in Iowa and Wyoming. And as I travel, Nebraska's got a lot of them. So I think it's arrogant for anybody to think that the application of technology and profitability, that there's some clear line there, that if you don't adopt technology, you can't be profitable in this business, especially with Wally World pumping carcasses. The other ranch that I think is becoming more common is a ranch that adopts technology, and I use the word chosen, I should have used choice probably, where they strategically choose technology to help meet a market end. And some of the nominees of the awards for this year's program certainly fit into this, and I applaud them. I think they implant or don't implant, they breed, they crossbreed, or they don't crossbreed, but that's all done strategically as a decision to get to an endpoint, and they can be very, very profitable. So I don't want any of us to leave this room thinking that all technologies are necessary for profitability. There's many examples where they are very profitable, and there's many examples where they aren't. I've been influenced in my life by an awful lot of people, and I just decided to share with you, and actually maybe it's to pass the blame for what's coming here, by some really great people. And the first person up there, Dr. Chris Dinkle, Mike's here, Mike McNeil's here. I wasn't a student of Dr. Dinkle. Dr. Gates is here, and we were in the same grad office together, the three of us. I wasn't a student of Dr. Dinkle's, and Roger wasn't, but Dr. McNeil was. Dr. Dinkle was a great scientist, and he is facing some very serious challenges at the end of his life, and I would encourage us all to keep him and Claudia in our thoughts and prayers, because he was a great scientist, and he impacted us, Roger, didn't he? Even across the hall in seminar, he made me a better, if I am bold enough to call myself a scientist, he made me a better person and a better scientist, even though I wasn't one of his students. But on down that list, John Lawrence, I don't know Wayne Purcell very well, but he has impacted me immensely in the last 10 or 15 years with his writings. Dr. Harlan Hughes is here, and it's the same way. And Tom and my good friend Eddie Hamilton. John Sermon and Jay Forrester at MIT, and although I know them and took some short courses from them, I read their work a lot, and they are brilliant men. And so it's been a great joy to know all those people and to be influenced by them. The last name up there I put in yellow because I didn't know M.B. Johnson. No one here knew M.B. Johnson. M.B. Johnson was at South Dakota State University as an ag economist, and he worked in the 1920s, and I'll talk about his work in a minute, but he must have been a tremendous scientist because his work is fabulous. Now, I'm not an economist, and Dr. Boggs is not sure that I'm an animal scientist either, but I needed to frame up some things for you today. And so I've always admired those presentations by Sparks and Cattle Facts and those really good economists where they put up those graphs and there's three or four axes and there's six lines and some are there's dot dot dash dash and there's dot triangle dash and there's pigs and cows and grain prices and the whole thing, and it's all on one graph, and they get done with their presentations and I'm wowed. And I tried that, and I can't do it, so I turned to the old thing, to your own self be true, and so this is the economic history of the cattle industry in my lifetime, according to me. I know that the real price of beef in my lifetime dropped, in my mature life, dropped dramatically, and now it's on the upswing, but it's got years to go before we're even close to what the demand was in 1974. 1972, I think, it was so high that Richard Nixon decided to put a price freeze on beef. We've got a great story in the last few quarters of this industry, but we've got a long way to go to recover where we were. I also know that the yellow graph, or the yellow line, is the domestic production of tons of beef, and all I know is it's gone up. 28 billion pounds, 29 billion pounds of beef, used to be 24, 22, just the domestic side. We are producing a tremendous amount of beef in this country. And the third line is that up there is that I know that in the early 1970s there were 130 some million total head of cattle in this country, and now there's 96, and it's gone way down. I also know that those lines and those slopes are impacted by policy beyond any of our control, certainly about trade and other things and the price of corn, et cetera, et cetera. I also know, and we all know in our heart, that a lot of that, of the slopes of those lines, has a lot to do with technology. If I gave you a laundry list of the technologies that were available for beef cattle production in 1974 versus what there were today, I think the young people in this room would be blown away. There wasn't scour vaccination. Three-way clostridial was a new thing. There weren't implants. Were just being tested. We were just coming out of the DES debacle. The Rumensin, where Roger Gates was doing his work on Rumensin with Dr. Embry, and I can go on and on and on. Now, AI and some things were sure there, but not used even at the rate they are today. Esker synchronization was just on the horizon. So the technologies that have been adopted and that impact this industry are immense. Crossbreeding was relatively new. Chris Christensen was here, and he was one of, and Arnold Wink, and they were some of the leaders of getting those genetics into this state, let alone this nation. And And I don't think we should dismiss the impact of technology. We can produce an incredible amount of pounds of beef, albeit we've got some awful cheap corn, with a lot fewer cattle, and that's production efficiency. So, my goals for today are to help to put into context the price tag and the profitability of technology. I don't have all the answers, and I'd love to stimulate a debate, and I don't pretend that I'm right on everything. I'm sure there's people in the room. I know John and Harlan are here that can help me out and make this better. But one of the things is that we're going to talk about is partial budgets and when and where they shouldn't be used. We're going to talk about measuring the impact of technology at the appropriate endpoint. We're going to talk about the cost benefits of change with different levels of production, the concepts of marginality. We're going to talk about how technology impacts the firm. If you remember back to your microeconomics class, it impacts the farm and ranch very differently than it impacts the industry. We're going to talk about unexpected outcomes and why they shouldn't be unexpected. We heard about that last night. The future value, and we're going to talk and end up talking about the future value of technology and how it needs to be discounted because that's the right way to evaluate change. So that's a partial budget, and I put a partial budget in the proceedings. It's a very simple tool, and it's a very, very useful tool. On the left-hand side, your left-hand side, you write down, as you make a change in your operation, you apply any technology, you write down the additional costs, you write down the reduced revenue, or if there is any, hopefully there isn't, you sum that, you go to the right side, you write down the additional revenue produced, you write down the reduced costs involved, and you come up with a net change. This has been the template for most of the evaluation of technology, certainly at the ranch level, but even at the feedlot level for the application of technology. Let's do a partial budget. Does it work? Is that a positive? We can put it in a little ratio and see if that thing works. Now, I'm here to tell you that it's a very useful tool, but I'm also here to tell you that it's a very, very limited tool. And in large business, it's used very, very carefully because it doesn't do more things than it does do. It doesn't measure risk. It doesn't measure quality of life. It doesn't measure the effect on cash flow. It doesn't measure repayment capacity on a loan and on and on. So while a partial budget is a good tool, if I apply this technology, what will be the outcome? It doesn't do very many things. And that one on quality of life, I really can't stress enough because it's one thing to talk about the application of a technology under controlled conditions at an experiment station or on a ranch where an industry has done have provided some help and some labor and other things. It's another thing to apply technology to a ranch or a farm or a feedlot that has very limited labor, etc. And so, you're putting up alfalfa, planting soybeans, AIing cows, sinking the heifers on and on and on, and there's still 10 to calve, and so quality of life really needs to be considered in the evaluation of technology. A couple more things about partial budgets. Certainly, variable costs are the most common thing to be listed in a partial budget, and that's good. They need to be there. But the things that they often don't answer are how much did the technology actually change the pounds sold? And I'm going to hammer on this one a lot. Lots of reports about, especially on the reproductive side, are, well, it increased pregnancy rates. and I'm probably jumping ahead on myself here a little bit, but in an extended beef cattle production system, in an extended production system like beef cattle production is, small changes can get washed out by many different things by the time you get the animals to sale. And what did it cost per hundredweight sold because of what I just said? The other thing that it doesn't do is that there's almost an assumption that if you've got a chute and a squeeze chute and some type of alleyway system or whatever, you can apply any technology. And so fixed costs, Harlan, are often left off in the evaluations. And fixed costs shouldn't be left off in the evaluations, I don't think, should they? I mean, if you're going to buy new things and depreciate them, you need to add those additional costs in. If you've got to upgrade and repair to get ready for that technology, you've got to add those things in. It's not as easy as just, you know, it cost me $20 a head to do this to a cow. I'm really a stickler about measuring where the impact of technology should be measured and should be reported. And a lot of this is the real life part. I've implanted thousands and thousands of baby calves, and I knew when I did some time at North Dakota State University as a research associate at the Carrington Station, I knew that there was a positive impact on weaning weight. But if I sold yearlings a lot and didn't re-implant and didn't have enough energy available and a good diet available to those calves, that a lot of that advantage that I would have picked up, that 10, 12, whatever pounds that is, would have been washed out by the time that I sold the cattle. And the next one, what is the value of a high carcass CPD sire to an operation that sells at weaning? To the industry is huge. To the man, to the person, the man or woman that made the investment in the cattle, if they don't retain ownership, they better hope they've got a heck of a ring man in the sale barn to help them out, because they're not going to be able to pick up those additional costs of buying that more expensive bull. So ester synchronization products, and I'm all for them, I'm not anti-technology, don't get me wrong, but what's more important to me than how many cows got bred or how many days did they calve in is how did it impact pounds sold at weaning or yearling or whatever that impact is, whatever that input is. And what did it cost me in terms of pounds sold, not per head? So the correct feedback is absolutely critical, and there's a little example about up there about how even with fixed costs you can mess this thing up. If your fixed costs are $100 per beginning year female, and you can produce the same number of weaned pounds with some type of technology with fewer cows, if you divide your fixed costs by cows, your fixed costs go up. Divide them by 100 weights of weaned calf, they stay the same. And that's the type of thought process we need to do always as we evaluate technologies. There's more than 6 data points on this slide. I don't put it up there for anything but to applaud Dr. Sandy Johnson for taking some leadership in this role and publishing work done with this type of thought process. Evaluating 2 different synchronization programs, 3 different semen costs, at several different labor costs, and what was the cost at the weaning time, what was the cost per hundredweight sold? That's excellent work. There's many other examples, but I think Sandy's kind of leading the way. I'll tell you a little bit about M.B. Johnson. M.B. Johnson worked for South Dakota State University in the 1920s, and he toured and recorded data on 60 ranches in the northwest part of South Dakota, the southwest part of North Dakota, the southeast corner of Montana, and the northeast corner of Wyoming, 60 in each state. Now, if you think back to 1920s, he had to be in a Model T. and it must have been tough. And he did whole ranch inventories on that many ranches. And there probably weren't a whole lot of motels, were there? And there probably weren't very good roads. He published his data in experiment stations, and he must have been on tenure track because he got the same pub in each four states. I'm on tenure track. And and his data's really good. And 60-plus years before we argued about SPA, he encouraged and he reported data as the number of calves weaned per cow exposed. And he talked about pounds weaned per cow exposed before any of us argued about it or whether or not it was the right definition. And he was right. He was right in the 1920s when he did the work. The concept of marginality is critical to talk about when you talk about technology. Because especially with single-type technologies or single-trait selection with a gene marker versus multi-trait selection with an index, think about it in marginality. As you push up on that barrier where you've eliminated the problem, something else becomes limiting, and your ability to affect change on that system is reduced. You can get 98% preg rates. You can do it. I've measured them. I've had them. You guys have had them. And getting 99% preg rates is very difficult. And it's much more difficult to jump from 98 to 99 than it is from 89 to 98. Does that make sense? It's because something else becomes limiting. And so along with that, the price for those small units of change go through the roof. Now, if you take just raw numbers and you think about weaning percents, weaning rates, in the northern plains, the SPA data that I did would say we're pretty good, about 87%. And in the southern plains, McGrann would say that that's about 83 or 84%. Well, that sounds like there's a lot of room on the average for improvement. And there probably is, especially with increasing demand for beef. I'd be trying to get as many more calves out of that deal as I can, those 100 cows as I can. But be careful. If you're at a very high level of reproductive performance, and your supplementations are solid, and your nutrition's good, and you're using breed techniques, and you're applying whatever technology you can, you've got early puberty, and on, the next unit of change will be very expensive. And so to make some broad-based statements that Rancher A should apply this technology because his preg rates will go up 5% and that's an affordable deal is probably not appropriate. It may or may not be appropriate, and unless you measure some numbers, you measure some costs, you're not going to know. The concept of marginality. It also works for price, and it differs at price at the firm level than it does the industry level. At the firm level, that demand curve there, and if John or somebody should explain to the rest of us why a demand curve is always straight. But that demand curve is straight at the firm level and level because no one firm in an industry this large can impact price. So it's always going to be level. Now, at the firm level, or the ranch or the farm level, we can inject the technology, and I think Dr. Odie's here, and for me, that's just Dr. Odie's work has just been a fabulous example of this, of applying a technology which has been herd health and immunization, et cetera, to create value in the marketplace. And so the application of the technology at the firm level raised value in the marketplace for those calves. And now if you don't have all the shots, you're penalized because Dr. Odie and others changed the culture of this industry by demanding that we take some steps towards quality. So that's our best, that's what we all want technology to do. As we apply technology, we want to either differentiate ourselves in the market somehow and make our product more valuable in the marketplace. But in terms of overall price change, that's always going to be level because we're all so small. Now, the other side of this technology is that a technology can actually drive price down at the firm level. And I'm going to pick on implants, and it's just historical, and I needed some example. But in the sale barns of South Dakota or Texas, it's amazing that no calves have ever been implanted. Now, if you think about how many, if you check the Zerenol and other companies, quite a few implants are sold for calf foot putting in calves. But at the sale barn, they've all had all their shots, and none of them have had any implants, right? Well, they have had implants, but nobody wants to tell anybody because if they do, they are valued lower in the marketplace. Whether that's right or wrong, it is probably wrong, and we all know that in this room, but that's this perception in the marketplace. And so a technology drives price down at the firm level. Straight-bred cattle, crossbred cattle. When I was a young person, crossbred cattle took the hit, didn't they? The first Baldies in the rings in Valentine, Nebraska were discounted in price. The Herefords that I sold in the Valentine sale barn were discounted in price 15 years later because they were straight bred, because I didn't apply technology. I chose a breeding system. Sorry, Craig, I didn't mean to pick on Herefords, but whatever breed. You've got to be awful careful at the firm level about the application of technology and your anticipated benefits that you're going to receive from it. Now, at the industry level, the demand curve is very different. And this is, you know, the Wayne Purcell curve that we all have come to know and love because it went our way. And now, I'm going to flip my order around. If you apply technology as an industry, and I'll pick on implants again, so we decide to implant lots of cattle in America, we lose, and I know it was political, whatever, but we lose the ability to send cattle to Europe, so we drop demand. There's consumers that have concerns about implants, and for those of us who actually saw a DES child, maybe that's not all insensitive. That was a terrible thing. And so we dropped demand, and we drove price down, and it didn't put all the lines up because I couldn't figure it all out. And you know, I finally kind of got it figured out, and I wanted to leave it kind of simple. And I hope that makes some sense to you. You can apply technology at an industry level that will drive price down because it changes consumer preference or consumer attitudes or whatever, and we've seen it. Now, you can do the opposite, and we've done it, you've done it, and I applaud you for doing it. New products, tender products, easy-to-cook products, less variation in what we do. So we apply, and this is a great example. If you think of CAB or CHB or Laura's Lean or one of these aligned production systems that have designated technologies, they've done exactly that. They've changed the demand curve by moving it up, and they've increased demand, and so they've increased price. And God bless them for doing it. It's been a great ride the last couple of years. So, technology has a different impact on the firm than it does the industry. It's very, very hard for a rancher to figure all that out. I'm going to talk about some unexpected outcomes that technology brings, and Dr. Boggs did a good job last night, I think, at questioning the speakers about what could be some of the unexpected outcomes of the technologies that were presented last night. Some of them, I just mentioned, the growth implants and European trade embargo. It doesn't make any scientific sense, but they did it. Wean weight and dystocia, that's an old one, but by golly, you know, some people were surprised in the 60s and the 70s when, as they drove weaning weight up, calving ease got tough and the number of live calves went down. That's bacterial resistance to antibiotics. An unexpected outcome of a very sincere application of the technology. Inbreeding and lethal traits. So, why is this a surprise? We've all been through someone's good course on genetics, and we're constantly surprised within breed associations that some lethal traits pop up or some undesirable traits pop up. Crossbreeding and longevity. I wrote to Dr. Cundiff in the 1970s about work done at Fort Robb, and he was gracious enough to share with me some of that early data. And I think longevity was probably an unexpected outcome. I mean, they knew right away that there were some very positive things about crossbreeding. But I think validating that with long-term studies on longevity was a very positive, unexpected outcome. Positive associative effects, negative associative effects, and ruminant nutrition have been kind of unexpected. I mean, we've got all kinds of ranchers in the United States who still feed corn as a supplement to cows on range, and the cattle don't do very well, and it's because they don't understand those fundamental principles of negative and positive associative effects that are going on in the rumen between starch and fiber and digestibility. Carbohydrates and obesity. Who would have thought? You know, I love bread. It isn't the amount of bread I eat, it's the bread, right? An unexpected outcome of eating bread now, it's not my fault, it's the bread company's fault. The next slide I put up here, I'm really taking a leap with you, and I don't mean to be insensitive to the shuttle astronauts that passed away a little over a year ago. This cartoon came out right before, very shortly before, that shuttle accident. And so it's sobering, and it's kind of funny, and it takes you back a little bit. But the line, for those of you who can't read it, is, in a technological breakthrough that revolutionized the space industry, NASA successfully launches the first space shuttle mission to be activated by the clapper. Now, hasn't that been America's approach to technology? You know, they can get a space shuttle up there, and they totally ignored that foam coming off that piece of equipment could have enough velocity and power to damage that shuttle. It's just insulation. It couldn't hurt anything. Unexpected outcomes of technology are real. They hit the space shuttle program, they hit our industry, and there are ways to deal with them. And we really need to go through the mental challenge that Dr. Boggs was doing last night with technology about saying, yeah, but what if, and not be afraid to explore those what ifs. One of the ways, and this is the work of John Sturman's at MIT and his predecessor, Jay Forrester, who grew up on a cattle ranch in Nebraska, and then started a whole body of knowledge called system dynamics. And this is a very, very simple example for you. The one in the proceedings is even simpler. And I went back to the calving, the weaning weight thing, because it's so easy for all of us to grasp. If we want to increase total pounds weaned, which most ranches do, because if we can sell some more cattle, hold our fixed costs, keep our variable costs low, Harlan, we're going to make some money, right? So that became the goal, increase total pounds weaned. And we've approached that through crossbreeding and implants and all kinds of different things. Well, that's a positive relationship. As one goes up, the other goes up. That's the assumption. Increase total weaning weight, total pounds of weaned weight go up. Well, after all these years of listening to very good people tell us that there are genetic correlations, why were we at all surprised that as we increase weaning weight, we also increase birth weight? And so as birth weight, because of that strong correlation, the positive signs mean that they both move in the same direction. And so then what happens? Well, we get down into this road a little bit and we see that dystocia increases. The same way, increased birth weight, we get increased dystocia. What happens then? If you increase dystocia, you increase calf death loss. What does calf death loss have to do with pounds weaned for a ranch? It's a negative relationship. You increase dystocia, you're going to decrease number of calves sold, or decrease live calves born, you're going to decrease the number of calves sold. And so I think in about 80-something, a lot of us woke up to, I get my pointer, that while we were doing everything we could down here to increase weaning weight, we really weren't changing weaning weight. And it'd be great to see some spot analysis of that period of time to see whether the application of technology, of those early technologies to increase weaning weight, actually increased total pounds being sold off the ranch. Because that's what pays the bill. So we absorb the cost of the technology, we absorb the cost of the dystocia, and we may not have, and I would venture to guess that we didn't actually have more total pounds to sell off the ranch. The best of intentions on the technology side and the unexpected outcome, and I show you this as a roadmap of how the folks at MIT and Dartmouth and other places, Ford Motor Company, General Motors, PepsiCo, lots of people use this type of simple approach to study unexpected outcomes. The R down there means it's reinforcing, that as you increase one, you increase the other. Balancing, means balancing, it balances itself out. You won't, if you've got competing interests there, you're not going to change pounds weaned. I'm going to jump now to the future value of technology. Because of that extended production cycle that we have, we are implored as scientists, as business people, to devalue or at least adjust that future value of those technologies because of something called net present value. The formula for it is simple, and it's in your proceedings, and it's widely used in planning scenarios all over the world as different companies evaluate changes in technology. The Ford Taurus, I bought my sons each a Ford Taurus, the old version, still remains the most widely, or the most, they sell more Ford Tauruses across the world than any other single model of car. And they changed it hardly any from the time it got on to the production line. And as I've read, one of the reasons about the history of Ford, one of the reasons they didn't change it was because none of the changes met the net present value test. That none of the changes that were proposed actually, after the value was depreciated out, would change the bottom line. People were still buying those ugly little Ford Tauruses, or Tortuses as my sons call them. So it's used heavily in planning scenarios. And the kicker maybe for us is that you have to have really good data to do it. And you have to have really good trend analysis to do a good net present value. Who would have thought that 2003 would be the year we saw dollar fats and the dollar plus fats? I don't think anybody saw that on the radar screen. And actually, in real good SD type modeling, they put in shock effects so that they can predict that. But it takes very accurate databases, ones that I'm not sure we have, and very accurate trend analysis. The other thing I'd like to just mention is that it really comes down to responsibility. Whose responsibility is it to tell me about the future value of a technology that I'm evaluating? Is it mine as a business person? Is it the extension services? Is it the researchers? Is it the company that's selling the product? I don't know that answer. Ultimately it's mine as the purchaser of technology. I should discount future value because inflation occurs and changes over time and demand changes and other things. And so, again, too many numbers, and I don't put it up there other than to applaud Dr. Meeks and the group at Colorado State for using this type of approach in the evaluation. I know Dr. Hughes has promoted it for years also. That we can use that simple little formula, and this graph is in your proceedings, and or this table is in your proceedings, and we can look at net present values. And it's important because it affects cash flow, it affects net income, gross income, all kinds of things, repayment capacities. And now the difficulty is that as I discuss a production function with you, and so production's on the x-axis and some dollars are up the y-axis, as I discuss that with you, I just threw a curveball because I just threw in another axis, the z-axis, and that's called time. And for anyone to put all, to assimilate all of this into one decision is really tough. What happens to beef production in a cyclical drought cycle that for the bulk of the, certainly the Great Plains, and that's, if I understand CattleFax's summary of where the industry is moving, this is where it's at. We know that we're going to have cyclical drought. And so we know that we're going to have cyclical changes in beef production driven not by consumer demand, not by technology, but by drought. Rapid liquidation, which will flood the market for short periods of time, and then as the herds are rebuilt, we're actually going to, just because of drought, we're going to lower beef production. And then the real price, not the nominal price of beef, I don't really, the real price of beef is affected by competing needs. And Dr. Lawrence can talk a lot better about this than I, but that's a wild card. And so now I've added the net present value, that you've got to deflate or at least adjust the value of technology into the future, and you really should, if you're going to do that well, overlay the cattle cycle into that. But who on earth knew that this would be the high point of which cycle, and how long are the cycles? This is a very, very complex decision-making process. And it's led to Rex the Wonder Dog as he is up on the high wire with a cat in his mouth, juggling balls with a hula hoop. Some of us remember hula hoops. Pedaling along, saying, high above the hustled crowd, Rex the Wonder Dog tries to remain focused. Still, he couldn't shake one nagging thought. He was an old dog, and this was a new trick. It is really tough for cattlemen on a ranch or in a feedlot to, if I can get this to go back, to put all that together. And so as you, as scientists and technologists, plan and challenge us to change and to adopt and to grow this industry, to improve beef cattle production, Beef Improvement Federation, I hope you'll always consider this type of technology, and that's simple. What I just described. I've become a very firm believer in a systems approach, and this is not my work. This was done by Forrester in the 1950s. And J. Forrester said, this young cowboy from Purdom, Nebraska at MIT, says that this is the process you go through. You describe the situation / problem, and there are some really neat tools being used to do that are not by consensus, but by discovery. You examine the mental models, and I don't know if Jim Gosses is here today, but Jim won't allow anyone to use the word paradigm, so we will use the word mental model. You examine your mental models about what you're studying. You measure and define the criteria, and that's what I tried to challenge us to do today, to put into context technology in terms of marginality, future value, and my other bullets. Use some wild tool like a causal loop diagram that Chevrolet, the General Motors, used to develop their hydrogen fuel cell car. You know, in a year, they did it in a year using a different process than most of us are acquainted with, and then develop simulation models. And the simulation models are actually very complex. Some of them have over 2,000 variables, and and they can shock their systems, shock their models, and get some really good results. So, partial budgets are a great tool, but they shouldn't be the sole tool that we as an industry rely on to evaluate the application of a technology. They're just not, you beat up another word, they're just not robust enough. They don't do enough. They don't evaluate choices. They don't evaluate future values. We need to measure impact of the technology on the output and understand where the rewards are going to flow. We need to understand the concepts of marginality, and that if you're a very profitable producer and have high levels of production, there are biological limits to this system, and unless we change those through some of those technologies we saw last night, it's going to be very, and they look pretty darn expensive, it's going to be very expensive to change them. Please understand that the difference of the technology impacts the firm differently than it impacts the industry. And I'm all for technology. Don't take anything I meant negatively. It just does. I maybe in the discussion period I can get back to those slides and we can talk about the seed stock industry, because it impacts the seed stock industry differently than it impacts the cow-calf industry. Unexpected outcomes of technology that Dr. Boggs was talking about last night shouldn't be unexpected. We better be, we can use methods to discover them, and then we need to at least adjust the future value of technology. So the challenge, my challenge to the Beef Improvement Federation is to move this discussion beyond improving just efficiency, which is a huge thing, but or production or consumer acceptance, and start thinking about improving nutritive value. I would suggest that none of us should celebrate the trouble that the carbohydrate industry is in the food part segment of our business. Food is being used, and we were targeted right after eggs, weren't we? Food is being targeted as a causative effect, or causative agent of disease. That's not a good thing. Food should be celebrated for its nutritive value, not be causing problems. And we can change the nutritive value of food with omega-3s. You guys are the scientists, the big guns, and we can do it. And we can sell a product that has nutritive value, and we can do a good job. And the other one is environmental. Cattle need to be looked upon. Beef production systems need to be looked upon, not plagues of society in Western Kansas, or in Iowa, or in South Dakota, or South Texas. In South Texas, people want to eliminate cattle because it disrupts their quail hunting. And they wouldn't have any quail hunting if they didn't graze. And so we need to explore and expand that part of our industry. And I don't, and there's methane and all kinds of things. Phosphorus, moving phosphorus. For an awful long time, this is a colleague of mine at Texas in Kingsville, Dr. Alan Fidenich. We've used the microscope, and I hope to take you to how you view the world. And so we reduce something down, and we study it, and we know it, and we're passionate about it. And that's how most of us were trained. And we might have three or four lenses, and now we've got much more sophisticated microscopes than that. But it's a good example. And that's valuable, that's an incredibly valuable thing to do, but so is looking at a landscape and looking through a pair of binoculars, perhaps, at the future. And I know I didn't take drugs in the 1970s, but that's a kaleidoscope, and what a kaleidoscope does is it allows you to change the lens in which you look at a situation. I did play with kaleidoscopes as a kid, and I now have a collection of kaleidoscopes because I love them. That you change, the light's the same, the diameters are the same. What you change is the lens, and so you see things differently. And so a systems approach is all of those things. A systems approach to solving a problem isn't just bury on a hilltop with a pair of binoculars. You need bench science, much more sophisticated than Alan's looking through. But you also need, we need to change the lenses on which and how we look at these problems. Well, it's been great. I learned a lot doing this talk, and I know that there's at least two gentlemen. There's a room full of people who know more about this than I do, probably. But I think, Jerry, we're going to break into some questions and answers. And Harlan's here, and John's here, and I might have to turn to some help if I get some that I can't handle. But I appreciate the invitation to be in here, and we'll anticipate a fun dialogue.